Good evening, this is Mark Lynch and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Chris Nashawaty. He's a film critic at Entertainment Weekly, a movie writer, pop culture historian, and I'm very happy that we're going to be talking about his new book, Caddyshack, The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella Story. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
How did you come to write this book? Like, why you and why Caddyshack?
Well, I mean, you know, I feel like a lot of people could write this book, but just because it's a movie that so many people love. You know, the truth is that, you know, when you tell people you're a movie critic for a living, they automatically ask you what your favorite movie is. And I think they expect you to say Citizen Kane or some high-minded film. And,
okay.
And I do love that stuff.
I love it.
But I grew up, you know, in the 80s watching movies like Stripes and Meatballs and Animal House and Caddyshack, of course. So those are the movies that are probably the closest to my heart. I think that's why I sort of felt like there was a great story here.
But, you know, the interesting thing is it's an interesting history because this is not just a story about that film, but it's literally a background story about a change up in humor that went over over a decade that led up to Caddyshack.
Yeah, I mean, my goal was obviously the title is Caddyshack, and there's a 2/3 of the book is about the making of that film, and it's a wonderful story because it was such a disaster to make. but yeah, I think you need to have a little bit of background about where exactly this movie came from. You know, a movie like Caddyshack does not just come out of the ether. It's sort of rooted in this revolution in comedy that happened between, say, 1970 and 1980, where the National Lampoon and Second City and Saturday Night Live sort of all came together with this new type of satire that the movie, you know, embodies.
And it's interesting. All of those things are interrelated. And so the people who are the sort of the stars of Caddyshack are all people who have a comedy history through all of these different institutions.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, if you go back and look at the National Lampoon, which, you know, was started in 1970 and was really, if you want to think of it as a cross between Mad Magazine and The New Yorker, you know, a mix of high and low brow, you know, there were a lot of great comedy writers who got their starts there. And then you go over to Second City in Chicago, which had been around since the 50s, but in the 70s you see people like Harold Ramis and Bill
right.
Murray and John Belushi and Gilda Radner and Dan Aykroyd all sort of, you know, sort of sharpening their comedy skills at this place. So, you know, I think in order to get a sense of how they all came together, you need to know a little bit about those places.
Well, and there were side projects for the National Lampoon that ended up being really important that ended up taking people from Second City over to the National Lampoon, things like Lemmings.
It's amazing that these creative comic geniuses found each other.
I know.
When you think about it, it was really something was in the air. It was like a kismet in the mid-70s where, yeah, I mean, I think Bill Murray says at one point in the book, when I was talking to him, he said that, you know, in that National Lampoon building at one time, there were more great comic minds in one building than there has ever been at any point in history.
And everybody's got a story, but I want to talk about Doug Kenny. Because if there's one central figure throughout this book, and it ends tragically, it's Doug Kenny. He got his start at National Lampoon, and he worked on some of the great projects of National Lampoon, including one of my favorites, the Yearbook Project.
Yeah, the Yearbook Project would ended up making its way into Animal House, which Doug was one of the writers of. You know, Doug Kenny is a fascinating guy. You know, I talked to about 75 people, maybe a few more, in reporting this book. And all of them, you know, said in one way or another that Doug Kenny was the smartest, the funniest, the wittiest, the most charming guy that they had ever met. And, I mean, these are some pretty smart, charming, witty people to begin with who were saying this. And I really think that he is the most influential comic voice of his generation that most people have never heard of.
That's right.
So I really felt like this was a chance to do him and his legacy some justice.
Now, Kenny had done a movie before Caddyshack. He had done Animal House. And he was actually in Animal House.
That's right. He plays Stork, who's sort of the pencil neck geek character who has one line in the film. What are we supposed to do now, you moron?
Right.
After John Belushi's, you know, great speech about was it over when the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor? Doug wrote Animal House along with Harold Ramis and another Lampoon writer named Chris Miller. And
originally there are the stuff that was brought up in your book that I'd love to read. They originally had written a script for a high school, like this was going to happen in high school.
Yeah, the pitch was Charles Manson goes to high school. And as soon as they started putting in all of these really raunchy gags and drug gags and sex gags, they realized that this would never fly if it was set in high school. So that's
I think it was called Laser Orgy Girls.
Laser Orgy Girls, that's correct.
Did you ever get a chance to read any of that script?
Laser Orgy Girls, as far as I know, does not exist in any form to read. But Harold Ramis told me quite a bit of the gags that are in the movie, and it sounds completely insane.
Now, Animal House takes off, gets amazing reviews. I can remember seeing it on like one of those previews before the official opening night. The audience was like crazy about it. So Kenny now gets offered to do another movie. That's a tremendous amount of pressure.
Yeah, it is. You know, he put a lot of pressure on himself, too. You know, when Animal House came out, it was almost overnight the highest grossing Hollywood comedy of all time. So there was a lot of real hunger and interest in what he and Harold Ramis were going to do next. So they decided, they pitched a number of ideas before finally landing on Caddyshack, which the idea they sort of stole from and brought in Brian Doyle Murray, Bill Murray's older brother, who had caddied as a kid, as Bill did, as all the Murray kids did, to earn money for Jesuit school just north of Chicago. And he had all these great stories about caddying for all these colorful characters and all the crazy caddies that they met and incidents like the Baby Ruth in the pool sort of thing that made its way into the movie. They could do no wrong by the time Caddyshack came along. They were given a tremendous amount of leeway because Hollywood thought that they knew something.
Now, the incredible thing is reading about Kenny's attitude towards money. He was pretty blasé about money.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, he was getting, when he cashed out of the Lampoon, after he had a 5-year deal, after he started there, he was a part owner, and he got this great deal where he could cash out after 5 years at like 13 times the magazine's earnings. So he's in his 20s when he leaves the Lampoon and an overnight multimillionaire. And then he writes Animal House, which makes him another multimillionaire on top of that. And I just don't think that he had a sense of it all came so easily to him that
he
had no sense of it. And there was someone who was telling a story in the book about being in Doug's apartment and going through one of the books on his bookshelf, and inside was an uncashed check from Universal Pictures for like $75,000. And Doug was like, oh, I was wondering where that went.
But is there a scene like that with Chevy Chase in the movie?
Yeah, that is a nod to Doug's sort of carelessness that's in the movie in Chevy's house where Lacey Underall finds the check and asks him about it. And he's saying, I wonder where that was. That's definitely Doug coming through.
Now, he begins to write this movie as he did Animal House. What was the original script like? Did he had to tone it down for the movie audiences?
You're talking about Caddyshack?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, the original screenplay was really nothing like, you know, the Caddyshack that we know and hopefully love. You know, the original screenplay focused on this love triangle between Danny Noonan, who's played by Michael O'Keefe,
yep,
you know, the young caddy, and his Irish girlfriend who works at Bushwood with him, and another one of the caddies. You know, all of the characters who we now think of as the stars of the film, Rodney, Ted Knight, Chevy Chase, Bill Murray, they were really peripheral characters who just made sort of these drive-by comic cameos. But when they saw how good these people were, how good Rodney was, how good Bill Murray was, they decided to just scrap this love triangle and just focus on them. And the movie, they just threw the script into the trash halfway through shooting and decided to just go in a different direction.
Now, they had to bring on a big star, and the big star in this case was Chevy Chase.
Yeah. Well, Chevy was the breakout star from the first season of Saturday Night Live. And when the season was over, he left to go to Hollywood and start a movie career. And he was successful. You know, he was a bankable box office star by the time Caddyshack came around. The only problem was that his replacement on Saturday Night Live, Bill Murray, did not get along with Chevy.
There's an incredible story in your book about them having a huge fight.
Yeah, it was an actual fist fight backstage at Saturday Night Live in 1978 when Chevy came back to guest host. You know, Bill, as the new guy, sort of felt like it was his job to be the Avenger and stick up for his castmates, and the two of them got into a pretty heated brawl backstage. And so when they both arrived on the set of Caddyshack in Florida, no one really knew how that was going to go.
And how are all the majors brought on? Like Rodney Dangerfield, if you're of a certain age, Rodney Dangerfield's career is sort of like it went up in the 50s, was sort of down, but then he had a revival. And that's when he was brought on Caddyshack. And he seems like one of the least likely people to get on with all these people.
Yeah, you know, Rodney was that part, the sort of rich vulgarian that he plays in the movie, that was originally going to be Don Rickles.
Sure.
But you know, Rodney at the time was really on a string of just amazing guest appearances on The Tonight Show. When he would come on, and you can watch these on YouTube, he would make Carson just melt into a puddle of laughter. You know, he'd wipe away tears. He was laughing so hard. So, you know, before they put the offer out to Rickles, you know, they were watching these appearances on The Tonight Show, and they said, you know what? I know he has no acting experience, but this could work. He might be perfect for this.
And was it automatically that he gets on the set, and it was automatic that these rest of these sort of younger, you know, comics who are just up and coming now, did they automatically get along with Rodney?
Yeah, you know, Rodney was older for sure, but he was definitely a younger spirit, you know, unlike Ted Knight, who was sort of a clean living guy, professionally trained.
Okay, that's one of the weirdest stories is the whole history of Ted Knight on the shooting of this movie.
Yeah, Ted Knight was definitely the odd man out, you know. This is a bunch of crazy people in Florida in 1979, which is pretty much Florida in 1979 is the gateway into the country for cocaine. So these people have, you know, a lot of money, no adult supervision, and really, you know, they're all just sort of starting out. So they don't know how movies are made. So it was just a big party. You know, I'm not saying that these people were doing lines of cocaine while they were shooting, but I promise you that, you know, after they wrapped for the day, they weren't going back to their room to study their lines, or a different kind of lines maybe they were studying. But they, you know, Ted just didn't, he didn't connect with this generation gap, and so it really drove him crazy, and especially when he was doing scenes with Rodney, who liked to party with the younger people. You know, Rodney didn't even know what the word action meant, and he would just spout out anything that came into his mind. You know, he was completely ad-libbing, and that was not how Ted Knight, who was just coming off the Mary Tyler Moore Show, worked. So he grew more and more, you know, enraged. So I would argue that that actually helps performance as Judge Smales. A lot of that anger is actually real.
It's amazing to read about him. I mean, he would actually show up on time on the set.
Yeah, and no one else would be there. I mean, he would just be sitting there holding a script and, you know, no one else was around. He just did not fit in, and I really think that because of that, he's the movie's secret weapon.
He really is, and you know, now that I read that in your book, and I go back and look at the movie, you're right. He really channeled that and put it into his character. I can really see that.
Yeah, I mean, I've watched the movie, you know, obviously a lot. And, you know, the first couple of times I saw it, I was really drawn to Rodney's performance or Bill Murray's performance. But the more I watch it, the more I realize that, you know, Ted Knight is really the unsung star of that film.
Well, he's really the sort of normal anchor that all the insanity sort of can revolve around.
For sure.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Chris Nashawaty. He's a film critic at Entertainment Weekly and a movie writer and pop culture historian. And we're talking about his new book. It's a great history. Caddyshack, The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella story. I just want to regress for a minute, Chris. One of the interesting things is you talked about is all this new humor and youth humor came out. What was passing for humor at that time? And it was amazing. You write about this. You know, people, it was like Neil Simon movies.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there were really, you know, other than Saturday Night Live on TV, the movies were really a wasteland for, you know, the kind of humor that connected with the baby boomers. You know, it had not caught up. So, you know, it's movies like Burt Reynolds and Smokey and the Bandit or George Burns in Oh God, or, you know, or Clint Eastwood with an orangutan in Every Which Way But Loose. You know, these are not the most cutting edge comedies. You know, there had been, you know, the Monty Python movies, but those were hardly mainstream. I guess the closest you would come would be like maybe Mel Brooks.
Right. And also John Landis had filmed the Kentucky Fried movie,
which was
somewhat like that. Now, you got to talk about Bill Murray coming on the set because, you know, reading your description of Murray to sort of wandering on the set, and I think doesn't he hook up with Cindy Morgan right away?
It's sort of like
playing the Bill Murray character in real life.
Well, I'm not sure where Bill Murray begins and his characters end. You know, he always is sort of Bill Murray in a way. You know, he was, as he is now, an impossible sort of enigmatic guy to pin down. You know, they knew that they were only going to get him for a week because he was just finishing a movie about Hunter Thompson called Where the Buffalo Roam.
Right.
And he was about to start Saturday Night Live. So they knew he was going to show up at some point. They just didn't know quite when.
that sort of seems weird.
That's just Bill being Bill. You know, he'll show up when he shows up. And finally he shows up, you know, he drives onto the set in a golf cart and says, which way to the youth hostel? And he immediately launches into his first scene, which, as you know, you've mentioned before, there were no lines. I mean, it was completely unscripted. And he just was that good of an improviser that he could just make up these great monologues like Cinderella story.
Oh, I love that. That's like one of the great. That's one of the great monologues on film.
Yeah, and it's Cinderella story is one take, just all from his mind. None of it's written down.
Now, this character that he plays is actually based on a character that he had developed in Second City.
Yeah, it's a character called the Honker. Bill had, and the people who knew Bill knew about the Honker. This was a character that he perfected at Second City in Chicago, and he would do all the time, you know, with his friends, and it was just one of the many characters that he had in his arsenal. And you know, when he showed up on the set of Caddyshack, they had no idea how he was going to play Carl, the demented assistant greenskeeper. But when they were shooting his first scene, which happened to be the Dalai Lama scene, you know, he twisted up his mouth into that sort of weird sort of, you know, rictus. And they thought to themselves, he's going to do Carl as the Honker.
Now, that scene that you're talking about, the Dalai Lama scene, is with Chevy Chase.
No, it's actually with a caddy actor.
That's right. That's
Peter
right.
Burkrot. Yeah, and I guess Peter Burkrot told me that they filmed it over 7 hours. And, you know, Bill has this pitchfork in his hand while they're doing the scene pressed up against the caddy's neck. And Burkrot told me that, you know, as each scene, you know, each take would go on, the blades, the tines from the pitchfork would go a little bit deeper into his neck because Bill was so sort of in the moment that he was not worried about his co-star's safety.
The scene I'm remembering, the one with Chevy Chase, is in Carl Spackler's house. I don't know if you want to. There must have been some anticipation of tension between those two characters because of their past history.
Yeah, for sure. There absolutely was. And I think no one was more concerned than Murray and Chase. You know, they did not know how this was going to go. You know, that scene is not in the script in Carl's shack, the whole pool or the pond thing. And that was added at the last minute because, you know, the studio was seeing the dailies and they saw how good Chevy was and they saw how good Bill was. and they said, you know, we have the two best comedians in the world in our movie, and they don't have a scene together.
Oh, man.
We better come up with one. And so they just wrote it that day, and those guys just ad-libbed most of it. And they really, you know, you can see they both admitted to me that they were trying to crack the other guy up. And if you look at that scene now, you can see both of them trying not to break. And you could argue, you know, looking back at it now with the knowledge we have, that that was really the moment in their relationship when the ice finally thawed a bit.
Chinch bugs.
Chinch bugs, yes.
I think that's the only film.
36 holes on and then smoke.
Now, you know, we haven't talked about who's directing this.
Harold Ramis, yeah, his directorial debut.
Wow.
Harold Ramis, of course, who would go on to direct Vacation and Groundhog Day and many, you know, great movies. He couldn't have been less experienced on this movie. But he was a little disappointed with the lack of control he had on Animal House. And I think that he felt that on his next movie, he wanted to have more control, which is why he sort of lobbied to direct it. You know, Ramis was a veteran of Second City. He had been there for years and was a firm believer in the whole philosophy of improv. So, you know, the fact that they made up so much of the movie, you know, isn't quite as reckless as it sounds. You know, Ramis knew what he was doing. Of course, when you make up a movie pretty much on the spot, you're really going to run into trouble in the editing room when none of it fits together, which is exactly what happened.
What about the gopher?
The gopher, you know, the gopher. Look, I'm going to tell you about the gopher because for the longest time, before I was reporting this book, I really hated the gopher. I just thought it was so childish and silly and stupid. But, you know, in the reporting, I sort of realized and found out that they only shot one scene with the gopher while they were down in Florida. And it was just sort of a throwaway scene. But the movie was so sloppy and messy in the editing room, they just had a bunch of really funny scenes, but they didn't connect in any way. So one of the producers, this guy John Peters, suggested that they go to the studio for more money, get reshoot some more scenes with the gopher, and just have the gopher pop up to connect all of these scenes. So he's sort of like the connective tissue that gets all these bits together. You could argue that the gopher saved the movie.
I don't know, but I wouldn't argue that. I wouldn't argue that. Okay, getting serious, the movie opens, and it's not well received.
Yeah, the critics really gave it savage reviews. It was not a beloved movie, especially, you know, when we consider that we're still quoting and talking about this movie nearly 40 years later, you would think that it was a hit right out of the box, and it wasn't.
What problem did critics have with the movie?
They thought, you know, if you go back and read the reviews now, they thought it was sloppy, and one of them called it an amiable mess, which is exactly what it is. But
it's an amiable mess. In other words,
it's not a nasty mess or a non-amiable mess. It's amiable, but it's a movie that is sloppy, and I think its imperfections are what make it perfect.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, the charm of the movie is the fact that it's not a polished film.
Exactly. I agree with you. But the critics at the time didn't quite see it that way. And when the one person they did single out as being good was Rodney. And the one person they seemed to really dogpile on was Bill Murray. That was a character they just did not care for at all.
And reading that in your book, I found that totally, you know, and I went to the Caddyshack when it opened. For me at that time, the Carl Spackler was what made the movie. I was immediately thrilled and amused by Spackler. Spackler was like hilarious.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And I just, you know, reading those reviews, you know, now, wondered like what happened. I mean, were they just in a bad mood or what? And they had poured on the praise for Animal House. I don't understand what happened at all.
Well, there's another thing that happened, which, you know, I guess I should go into as well. And that's, you know, during the press junket, when all the critics get a chance to finally see the movie. That was held in New York a couple weeks before the movie opened. And Doug Kenny, by that point, was really sort of crestfallen by the way the movie had turned out. He knew it wasn't another Animal House. And he had been taking a lot of cocaine, and he was really spiraling in a bad way. And at the junket where they showed the movie to the critics, he sort of mouthed off to them in ways that I cannot say over the radio, but in very sort of demeaning, nasty ways. He did not help his own case. So I think a lot of the critics maybe who were there decided to stick it back to him when they were writing their reviews.
Do you feel that it was this bad reception for Caddyshack that pushed him over the edge and killed himself?
You know, I don't know. It's hard to say, and I'm not sure he did kill himself. You know,
I know. And then there are people who are saying that he slipped and it wasn't intentional.
I mean, if you know, about a month after the movie came out, you know, he was pretty devastated by the bad reviews and the way it came out. So, and he was peaking when it came to his cocaine abuse. So he and Chevy Chase went to Hawaii to try to dry out. They went there for about a month, and they didn't, you know, the whole dry out idea didn't last very long. Chevy eventually went back to L.A. to do a movie, and Doug stayed behind alone. As time went on, people hadn't heard from Doug, and eventually they found him at the bottom of a ravine. You know, they don't know if he slipped or if he fell, or as Harold Ramis famously put it, he slipped looking for a place to jump. You know, that whole they don't know what happened, but it's entirely possible that, you know, that it was suicide. I'm just not sure.
And it's a tragic ending to this entire book, because the movie, again, is beloved now. It's a comedy classic. It's one of the sort of key comedy films made at that time period. And you sort of really wonder what he would be up to if he was still alive today.
Yeah, I mean, to me, he's really the heart and the through line of the book. I think in a lot of ways, his spirit is the spirit of the movie. I wonder that as well. I mean, to me, Doug Kenny is just a fascinating character, and it is a tragedy that not only that he died, but also that he never got to live long enough to see
the movie
become as embraced as it was.
Amazing. My guest tonight has been Chris Nashawaty. He's a film critic at Entertainment Weekly, movie writer and pop culture historian, and we're talking about his new book. It is a great read. Not only is it funny, but there's some fascinating comedy history in this too. Caddyshack, The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella Story. Chris, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.